Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. America hasn't seen this level of civil unrest in at least 50 years. Are these movements of liberation? Is this a pursuit of anarchy? With an election coming up, the 2020s might feel a little bit like the 1850s. In the 1850s, all of the attention was on bleeding Kansas, not bleeding Portland or bleeding Kenosha. Kansas was coming into the Union of the United States, and everyone was worried about it because people knew that with the addition of two more senators, if this was a slave state, there would be the slave states would have a majority of senators. If it was a free state, the free states would have a majority of senators. And so both sides rushed into the state ahead of the referendum. It was discovered that the state itself would vote as to whether or not it would be a slave state or a free state. So settlers from slave states and free states dashed into the state in order to hopefully gain the upper hand. Now, some towns were pro-slavery and some towns were against slavery. And so what actually broke out was something like gang warfare to try and intimidate the others to leave the state. Now, One of the biggest incidents here was called the Pottawatomie Massacre. Lawrence, Kansas was a free settlement. And it had a newspaper. In many ways, the propaganda war in the 1850s was just as hot as it is now. And before the age of the internet, newspapers were the main way for both sides to promote their cause. There were a couple of newspapers in Lawrence, Kansas that were raided by pro-slavery side, Missouri ruffians, as sometimes they were called. And they destroyed the printing presses, and people were upset by this raid. A certain individual, John Brown, who was an abolitionist with his sons and some friends, decided to go at night with broadswords to the homes of people suspected in the raid. That evening, they interrogated and put to death three men and two adolescent sons. And this was May of 1856. John Brown went on, quite a bit more famously, in 1859 to attempt to incite a slave revolt in the South. His idea was that if he could gain a stock of weapons close to the slave areas, he could pass out those weapons to slaves and they could rise up, and this would incite a slave revolt. In some ways inspired by Nat Turner, who tried to launch a slave revolt a generation earlier. He would arm the slaves by taking the weapons from the armory at Harper's Ferry, and that was his plan. Unfortunately for John Brown, he wasn't a very good planner, and almost right away, the taking of the armory went dreadfully wrong. Others went out to try to encourage slaves to revolt and rise up against their masters so that they could distribute the arms to get the slave revolt going, and it all came to nothing. John Brown was arrested and sentenced to death for his attack on the armory, and he was hung. After his hanging, they found a note in his cell which said this: "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood." And this was seen as a prophetic cause anticipating the American Civil War. This was 1859. In 1861, in April, the city of Charleston fired on Fort Sumter, which was held by the Union. The Union didn't want to give it up, and the Civil War began. Now, why didn't the slaves free themselves? Well, it's difficult to know whether they could have, obviously, because the South was well armed, and while there were significant numbers of slaves in the South, there were more whites who would have been available to put a slave revolt down. But both in Egypt and in the South, slaves were concentrated in numbers, and it was a perpetual fear on the part of slave owners that slaves would rise up or maybe just slit their throats in the night. We've read that in earlier chapters in the book of Exodus, and it was a common fear in the South. And this tends to be a common fear anywhere slaves are kept. Human beings make particularly bad slaves. We're way too smart, we're way too independent, and unlike domesticated animals, we have minds and we think and we long to be free. But there are shackles and scars on the outside And there are scars and shackles on the inside which bind the mind and bind the spirit. And so while slavery has been very common throughout the history of the world, slave revolts have been relatively rare. Now, in the case of the American Civil War, the slaves actually didn't free themselves. A few had escaped. Some would go on to fight for the Union cause. Many more would be laborers for the Union Army. But the sacrifice of blood sufficient to free the slaves that John Brown talked about was made mostly by the sons of the North, who were not slave owners. Some of them weren't particularly passionate about the abolitionist cause either. Many of them went to war to save the Union, not necessarily to free the slaves. And of course, much later in the Emancipation Proclamation, Abe Lincoln would free the slaves, but only in the rebel states, not in the border states. The slaves in the border states would have to wait to be freed by changes to the American Constitution, which would happen a little bit later. Most in the war were fighting to save the Union, but the sacrifice of blood of the North and the South eventually won the freedom of the slaves. At this point in the story, the Israelites are about to be set free, and up until last week, we've looked at 9 of the plagues or wonders, and now we're at the 10th. Now the Lord had said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. And when he does, he will drive you out completely. Then tell the people that men and women alike are to ask their neighbors for articles of silver and gold. The Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and Moses himself was highly regarded in Egypt by Pharaoh's officials and by the people. So Moses said, this is what the Lord says. About midnight I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the female slave who is at her handmill, and all of the firstborn of the cattle as well. There will be a loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there has ever been or ever will be. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any person or animal. Then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Israel and Egypt. Notice the Lord is saying, I will go throughout Egypt, and I will kill them. All of these officials of yours will come to me, bowing down before me, saying, go, you and all the people who follow you. After that, I will leave. Then Moses, hot with anger, left Pharaoh. What's interesting about that little passage is it's sort of a mental picturing of what it would be, even though that confrontation isn't actually described in the text. The Lord had said to Moses, Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in Egypt. Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let Israel go out of his country. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. Now, with the story developing as it is, why does the story take this turn? It's almost like the narrative is interrupted, and suddenly we're going to talk about calendar, and we're going to talk about ritual. Now, one of the things that I've thought a lot about in my conversations over the last 2-3 years on YouTube are exactly where are the lines between believers and skeptics. One of the deepest line is the assertion on the part of skeptics that there are no conscious agents above or beyond us with whom we can communicate, relate, rely upon, or with whom we can associate that may in any way change the circumstances in the physical world. And so it's interesting that here, right in the middle of the passage, we get into a portion that is basically talking about a ritual. What they are about to describe is a ritual that is intended to effect a change. The message is quite clear. Israel is to perform this ritual, and through this ritual, they will be saved. The Egyptians will not perform this ritual, and in every household, the firstborn will die, not only of the people, but even of the cattle. What is going on with this? And it is, in fact, the Lord who will take the lives of those individuals. The animal you choose must be a year-old male without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Now notice the symbolic nature of this. Notice how it's going to happen in the dark. Remember, the last plague was darkness. Darkness is coming. Darkness will descend on everyone, and Israel must prepare for the darkness by taking a yearling, a lamb or a goat, and slaughtering it. Then you will take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where you will eat the lambs. Now, I enjoy a movie on the history, a television show on the History Channel called Alone. And in the show Alone, it's quite interesting because people go out and live, lately it's most of them have been in the Arctic, and they trap rabbits and they shoot squirrels, many of whom are quite pretty and cute. And when they take the lives of these little animals, it's interesting how they often apologize or thank them for their life. The participants in this program have a very vivid idea that there's an exchange going on, that the life of the rabbit or the squirrel or the fish or the muskox or whatever animal they manage to kill will be taken in exchange for their own. That's what's happening here with the sacrifices. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roast it over a fire with the head, legs, and internal organs. Do not leave any of it until morning. If some is left until morning, you must burn it. Now, this isn't just cooking instructions. This is a carefully prescribed ritual. And if you've paid attention to some of sermons a while ago where we talk about how altars work, remember God describes himself as a consuming fire, and he appears to Moses in a burning bush. And so in many ways, the fire is sort of an altar motif, and the animal goes into the fire, and none of the animal must be left. It's wholly given to God. And the blood, Israel will be given a command not to eat anything with blood in it. Well, the blood will go on the doorpost. And by following the prescription, the people who do it will be saved. This is how you are to eat it: with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. In other words, when the sun starts to go down, slaughter the lamb. Put the blood on the doorposts. Cook it over a fire, head, legs, internal organs, everything. Eat it, dressed, ready to leave. Anything left over, burn. Give it to the Lord and be ready to go. And if you don't do this, you too will lose your firstborn. On that same night, I, the Lord, will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. That's what this has been about the whole time. Who is the Lord? I don't know the Lord, Pharaoh says. Well, he knows him now, and he's been seeing that his system of gods is impotent compared to the God of Israel. I am the Lord, the Lord declares. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. At midnight, the darkest part of the night, notice darkness, remember last week's sermon. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all of his officials and all of the Egyptians got up during that night, and there was a loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "Up, leave my people, you and the Israelites." What a change of message. "Go worship the Lord as you have requested. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go. And also bless me." Pharaoh now knows something he didn't know before. Pharaoh now knows who the Lord is. The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country, for otherwise, they said, we will all die. So the people took their dough before the yeast was added and carried it on their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. The Israelites did as Moses commanded and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and they gave them what they asked for. So they plundered the Egyptians. After the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and gives it to you, as he promised on oath to you and your ancestors, you are to give over to the Lord the firstborn of every womb. Wait, I thought the ritual was to save our firstborn. But the Lord seems to still be asking for the firstborn, even of Israel. How are they to be consecrated? Well, there'll be an offering given in place of the firstborn. There'll be a substitute. The yearling lambs were substitutes for the firstborn of Israel. And this will continue. All the firstborn males of your livestock belong to the Lord. Redeem with a lamb, just like at Passover, every firstborn donkey. But if you do not redeem it, break its neck. This Passover is to be a continual thing, and it will be ritualized and remembered and rehearsed. Redeem every firstborn among your sons. Who paid to redeem the slaves of Egypt? It was the innocent children of the enemy. It was the innocent offspring of the sheep and the goats. Someone else paid for Israel's freedom. Israel was to remember this on penalty of exile from their community. Year after year, they would rehearse it so as not to forget. They were bought with a price. Someone else paid for their freedom. Their freedom is precious and should be remembered, and those who sacrificed should be remembered. Every year, they had to take a lamb, and they had to take its life to remember that they are not their own. Their freedom was purchased by the sacrifice of the innocent. Now, the games show contestants of Alone live in the wild to realize that their life is lived at the cost of the innocent. Civilization covers that up, although sometimes we get a sense of it. You came into this world at the risk and the cost of the lives of others, starting with your parents. You live in a land taken in bloodshed. You eat by the death of plants and animals. None of us are our own. All of us live upon the sacrifices of others. Now, a lot of people look at this and say, how horrible of Israel's God to go through the land. Yet, at other moments, when we see death in the streets, we say, well, it's justified. And when pressed to give justification why such and such a person would die, oh, it's for the greater good or the greater cause. These are arguments we usually make in war. You see, the God of Israel is not like the gods of Egypt. There's a categorical difference. According to Egypt and pretty much every other civilization, the gods are sort of like us. They are actors inside the system, but the system itself is this impersonal thing. The imagined gods of Egypt and polytheism are actors like us, bound by the system. The God of Israel is the author of the system and can be an actor within it, and in this case is via the angel of death. You'll notice in the Old Testament that when God takes on agency like ours in the way that we express it, it's sometimes the angel of the Lord or an angel or some sort of way. But God himself is different from the gods of Egypt. Egypt had power and agency by the sacrifice of the children of Israel. And now Israel will have her freedom at the sacrifice of Egypt. Now, we tend to think that freedom is free. We tend to think that freedom is a natural state, and if human beings are left alone, they are simply free. But that's never the case. We have debts we do not know. We live upon the death of plants and of animals, and we live in structures that are built upon the deaths of others. And the bonds and the scars that we have are often not seen. They're not obvious. We are like children who can't see the sacrifices of their parents and ancestors who bought their freedom and our agency with their lives. Now we fear a God who would kill and demand the firstborn. The firstborn is only a token, however, of everything that the God owns, which is, of course, everything. The firstborn is the first fruits. And this really bothers us, because once we see how this God is, we recognize we are all dependent. We're not free ourselves. We live at his disposal. And when we recognize that, we wonder, can he be trusted? And then in this story, the unthinkable happens. Passover, the continued remembering that the firstborn must be redeemed, that we all live at the pleasure of this God, that we all live based on the sacrifices of others. God flips the script, and instead of demanding the sons of Pharaoh and the sons of the slave woman needing bread and the sons and the offspring and the firstborn of the cattle, God offers his own firstborn son for the rebels of the world. The owner of the system reciprocates and sacrifices to free the slaves from other parts of the system. He gives his firstborn son. The Passover pattern was followed at the meal. When he's gathered with his disciples, it happens as the Passover meal. And what Jesus does in that meal is connect what he is doing with the sacrificial lamb. Jesus, the firstborn son, will die, and the sacrifice of lambs will end. This is the pattern of the world. This is the pattern of sacrifice. This is the pattern of liberation. And the point of the offering given to us. On the night he was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And he said, "This is my body given for you. This is my blood poured out for you. As often as you receive this, do this in remembrance of me." He becomes the lamb. The church becomes the offering. And the church and the lamb take part in the drama together. We have received, and so now we give. And that's the pattern. That's the story of liberation. It's the story of how slaves become free, not only from external bonds, but internal scars. And it's the story of the God who, yes, takes the life of the firstborn, and then gives his own firstborn for the sake of the rebels.